Retroactively, can we claim a place? I forgot, in passing through the Dordogne and Spanish areas there, to claim the caves at Altamira, etc. But here's a piece of metamorphic rock from there that might get them back for us. It's called Stone Age. Whoever broke a rock first wasn't trying to look inside it, surely. Just looking for an edge, trying to hammer with it, maybe. It broke. Then he saw it glitter, how bright inside it was, noticed how things unseen are fresh. Maybe he said, it's like the sky that when the sun has crashed down through the west, breaks open to the Milky Way, so we see farther than we're seen for once. As far as light and time can reach, and almost over the edge of time. Its spiral track like agate swirls in rock, from when it still was water stains, had not yet found its non-solution to the puzzle of dissolution. Keeping within its darkness the traces of its origin, as day keeps night, as night keeps stars. Pebbles, headstones, Altamira, dust wrinkles over darkness. What shines within? Got a. Maybe I better get back to Oklahoma here. I've been doing some of this over the weekend. I figured I had to do a reading here, so better do something about it. So I wrote a few pieces. Actually, this one I got done back in January, February. Junko is not somebody on cocaine snow. Junko's a little bird that hops on real snow. And I guess you know they come in the wintertime. And little slate-colored juncos. I'm always surprised by how little I know about birds and how much less a lot of other people know about birds and probably how much less they're interested. But this is just called January. It's part of a story I've done. It hasn't been published. I don't know whether it will be. There was one of the great old dancers for Ponca ways. There was Elmer Brown, then his son Sugar. Called him Sugar Brown. I guess they didn't want to call him Brown Sugar. But they were great dancers. And I was back home this month, I guess, early part of it. I had to give a medieval paper in Stillwater, and then I went up. I'm trying to work out a way in which some of those recordings in the Smithsonian Institution made in the early 1900s, some of them on those old wax cylinders. If I can get those to be re-recorded, then I'd like to have them presented to Osage people and taken back and stored, put again into the tribal museum there in Pawhuska. So there's going to be a meeting in Washington this December, and I'm helping to run a forum on things, and it'd be really nice if I could get that done so that some of the people I've written, George Tall Chief, is actually the chief of tribal council now. I haven't heard from him yet. He may say the hell with this nut, but be nice if we could have him come to Washington this time, or somebody else, maybe some of the people. Hazel Aloha, for example, Hazel Harper, is the granddaughter of one of the guys who gave those old ceremonies. I'd like very much to see the naming ceremony brought back and put in the tribal museum there. When I was given my own name in 1952, it was a day and a half ceremony, but it was very different from the old ways. And I spent some time in the last couple years doing some talking with the old people and the others who know about the changes. Osage has decided to throw those things away, so I hope we can get some of the old ones back. They're full of songs and they're absolutely wonderful, but won't go into it now. I put this in because this particular poem here for Elmer Brown, when I was back, I got to go over and see my Ponca folks too, and they were telling me some more about him. When I was there in 1981, he was in a wheelchair. He's been in a car crash, and he's paraplegic. He got one lung ruined, and his arm's not very good, but he can hold a beer or hold a smoke. So it was kind of remarkable because my Ponca folks have a particular place for the Ponca tribal dances that they always camp down there. And when I went this time in 81, he was down there too. I had never met Elmer, or Sugar, rather. Well, Elmer, I'd call him. Because I'd always been away or something or another. But they'd been very close. And he'd been a circus performer as well. He'd been out to Hollywood as a stuntman, circus performer, a lot of other things. So it was kind of shook me up to see him sitting there in a wheelchair with my folks bringing them around to the dances to watch the dancers, thinking of what he used to do 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I did a short story in which I had that, but I'm too long to read. So I'll do the final poem from it, which is about this junco hopping on the snow. It's called January at this point. Here's a junco neatly hopping, print, 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 in the brilliant snow. Now he pulls his feet up into the white soft down of belly feathers. He sits fluffed like charcoal gray heat sink. Brooding in the snow, Shakespeare said. Nah, warming his toes and thinking which seed ball in the tree, his sweet gum granary, he'll fly up and hang from while he feasts. Below zero on a sunlit day, blue sky, feathers full of sun, his crop filled, his message hieroglyphed on snow. You track me this far, you blue-eyed weasel. See me sitting on my death, and then a blur where trackers say I ended. Weasel looks up where I hang on the round seed ball under the round undying sun, already turning north toward new leaves and flowers. His poem called The Only Other Ponkas in Los Angeles. My folks went out there, some of them. My Uncle Woody, white Uncle Woody, married Ponca woman Aunt Jewel. We used to live around each other. My earliest memories are of being kept down there while my mother and my stepfather were courting. Earliest picture that they have of me and my twin sister, who is now about 21 years younger than me. Died in 63, I guess it was. The earliest picture is of one of us up against an Indian blanket down there on the Ponca place. Somehow one of those photographers came by in the Depression and talked him into spending, I don't know, God knows what, to get pictures made. This is called The Only Other Ponkas in Los Angeles. They went out there to California, worked their way up and down from the Imperial Valley, lettuce and stuff like that, up to Washington and the apples and cherries, and go up and down and make their living. Migrant workers, all Mexican, I guess. Some Ponca. This is when they were out in Los Angeles. And this is a story my cousin Darlena and Susani told me. You know how big Los Angeles is? My cousin Susani said. Well, there we were, coming back across the street from that official business, which I needn't describe to you. You grew up with it, too. You know how hard it is to raise the money, and you hate to hand it over to pay the court costs, as they put it. And there was Mama when we crossed the street, and we could tell right off, just from the way she sat there looking straight through the windshield, not wanting to tell us what she'd done. Oh, no, I said to Serena, I bet our last $10 just went down the street. And sure enough, there was an Indian guy walking away, not looking, just heading straight for the liquor store. Oh, Lord, Serena said, wouldn't you know in this huge city there'd be one other Ponca and he'd find our mom and she would know him from the res and he'd be starving and she'd say she had only a little but she had to help. When we climbed into the car, Mom said, I couldn't help it, you guys. That poor guy, he was Edgar Big Snake's boy. I knew him back at White Eagle. His mother was Auntie Dora's friend. So what'll we eat, Mom? That was all Susani said that she could think to say. But then her mom began to cry. And so Serena said, what the hell? You know we'll live. We'll just go hungry for a little bit. At least, their mother said, we did what Ponkas ought to do. He said we were the only Ponkas we had seen since he left home. Here's another solution for the Indian problem. Just a suggestion, General. That K County Courthouse is really a big old thing. has marbled halls and wide echoing lobby space to walk through on our way to visit the not yet innocent or temporarily guilty relatives once more. That's why the little grandson Alexander was so impressed the time he first went with his mom to visit his grandpa there, the year Alec was four or so. He looked around, he looked up, he tilted back his head, he said, "Wow, Mom, Grandpa really got a big house this time." Cracked her up, you know, she told me. "Really, though, I think by now we've almost paid the rent, don't you? Let's say," I said, "if they decide to go condo, we'll own a healthy share of it." So that's what I'm proposing here. Us Indians have paid out fines enough to get the courthouse lots in most counties now. Listen, you think, they'd never listen. But what the hell? There's some of those courthouses nicer than that church up at Wounded Knee. They'd keep out bullets better. Just in case we, what about squatters' rights? A place not clean and not well lighted to play cards in, write letters from, to sober up, to be without all privacy and deprivation, where they can come and see us and give us orders, feed us the surplus food, the ultimate allotment. Send it in care of the Kay County Jail. This is called How Shakespeare's Wiping Out the Bluebirds. I know a telephone pole with two holes that red-headed woodpeckers made. But the last time I saw birds nesting there, they were bluebirds. What a shock. Hadn't seen bluebirds for quite some time. Around the towns, it seems like all the holes are full of starlings. They don't migrate. So they're on the spot and get the first pick every spring. They're bigger than the bluebirds. Gang up on them. Just made for taking over. Can't blame the starlings, really. The one to blame is William Shakespeare. He wrote about those starlings. Remember how Hotspur lost his temper? Swore he'd have a starling taught to speak. He'd put it loose in old King Henry's palace and holler Mortimer in Henry's ear all day. This was when the English throne was up for grabs, in Shakespeare's version. And then some fool Americans, 300 years or so later, they wanted to have all Shakespeare's flora and fauna on American soil. And so they brought some starlings over. They turned loose six pairs or so in Central Park. Columbus never set a worse example. Now the city-loving starlings rule the roost. I have no doubt they'll take the country as soon as city people set up holes enough to make them feel at home. Well, the bluebirds in that telephone pole will last a year or two. There are lots of dead trees they might nest in. Out in what might be the woods where ranchers sprayed with Agent Orange, unless, of course, there's more dioxin than insect life can stand, and bluebirds won't have any food left to live on. Bluebirds, Pequods, Mohicans, etc. Well, I guess the continent can do without them. Small price to pay for the Bible, or for William Shakespeare, who has filled the schools as tightly as the starlings have filled the nesting holes on reservations. Bibles don't leave much room for other versions of creation. They turn native religions into myth, just the way starlings do bluebirds. What the hell, survival of the fittest and all that? Maybe the Indians better start writing plays and put bluebirds in them. Couldn't hurt now, could it? And once the Russian tourists come over, they'll take back several pairs. Maybe I'll be the Shakespeare whose poems killed off some Russian bird. Jesus, you redskin poets. Let's be careful what you write out here. Here's a poem called Making a Name. The authors of this story are my Ponca folks, Aunt Jewel and Uncle Woody. I am directing the movie made from the story, so come on with us. Here we go now. You hear them laughing everywhere as we're looking down from the sky, dodging a bewildered buzzard here, float over the concrete taffy strips of an interstate. I-44 it is. Look out, we're heading for a cloud. The hail and wind are blinding us. We're in the cloud and whirling. Now the cloud turns dazzling white before us and we break out into sunlight. Above us, a cobalt blue sky, behind a brilliant white wall of cloud. Below, aha, you see that red line there? That's Oklahoma line. Aunt Jewel laughing. We zoom southwest over rain-drenched green. Rectangles of winter wheat sparkle behind us with a sun path leading eastward beneath a line of thunderstorms straight into the morning sun. But look ahead now. The silver shallow meanders of the Arkansas. On this side now the Osage Reservation, on that western side the Ponca Lands. Now we can see Uncle Woody gunning a Model A coupe down US 77, heading for Anadarko maybe, he and Uncle Gus. And we're coming down, we're circling on the wings of this red-tailed hawk above the straggle of houses, clapboard with the white paint almost gone, and there on the back porch of this old house, a small boy standing with his foot, what's that he's standing with his foot in up to the knee almost, a slop bucket? Filled with garbage for the pigs, cold water with greasy scraps of lettuce and tomatoes, mushy biscuits floating. That little kid, ooh, listen to him swear. I listen. My God, that's me. I still remember how that cold water came up my leg. See, I was going out from this back door here into the yard this morning, going to play in those rain puddles there, but stepping off the back porch had my eyes entirely on that great big Dominecker rooster watching me stand here swearing now. And watching him, I stepped off with one foot into this bucket here. But what I can't get over, Aunt Jewel tells us, laughing still. Still not gray-haired, no. Now her 70th birthday coming up. But see her here on the back porch, she's not yet 20. Just come out to see what in the world her little nephew's cussing so steadily about. What I can't get over is that you never took your foot out. Just stood there cussing the blue streak at your foot and at that big slop bucket. My, you could swear. Here you were, this little three-year-old. I guess you picked up all those words from your grandpa Camp when he was plowing the garden up that month, and you had followed with him behind the mules and plowing. Those were lazy mules. So when I came out there on the porch to see you, Mike, to see what you were swearing at, why, there you stood with one foot in the slop bucket just cussing the blue streak. You know my blind great-aunt? She was in the back bedroom. She heard you there. She was amazed. she said, listen to that boy. Where'd he learn to talk like that? She was really old by then. She'd come down to Oklahoma when us Poncas were forced down from Nebraska back in the 1870s. Oh, we laughed and laughed about it. All the time we took you in and cleaned your leg and shoes up, she told me, you sure have got a smart nephew, daughter, to know all those bad words. Well, of course, I had good teachers. Learned my English words from experts. But who knows? The chance to practice all of them might never have come to me had I not lived for some time in my youth with my feet set firmly on an Indian reservation. Here we are now, back in St. Louis, gateway to the West. And how'd you like flying under the arch with real live Indians this time? Let's see. Let me try something I wrote over the weekend. Been teaching great books, Iliad, Aeneid, stuff like that. Ovid a little bit, just to take the taste out, kind of a chaser. Don't use chasers anymore, do you? It's upper here, downer there, you don't got the need for chasers anymore. This is called Lighting Up, number one. A little bit of a change of pace because it has more to do with New York and LaGuardia. But teaching Epic, I've been trying to get back and forth saying, you know, here we are, Empire. What the hell are we doing here? How'd we get here? And you know what John Wilkes Booth said when he jumped down, turned his ankle. He didn't say, God damn it to hell. He said, Sic semper tyrannis. What I'm interested in is he said it in Latin. Now, he kind of thought that he was Brutus and that Lincoln was Caesar. That may be true. We were certainly changing from a republic to an empire long about then. But he may have had the wrong side. Who knows? Anyway, he did say it in Latin. So I've been thinking a lot lately about Rome and Washington and so on. You walk around in Washington and what you see is the Capitol, as it's called. Roman architecture, it's called, and Greek and Roman pillars and stuff like that. But this isn't Washington, this is only New York. Lighting up, number one. These neon lights are to stars what Odysseus is to Dwight Eisenhower. I'm talking what you see at night coming into LaGuardia in clear skies, watching those inside-out cathedrals of commerce, under the dark windows of your plane, looking down past the massive tilting wing with its magically shifting ailerons, its insect-like adjustments, creaks and thumps that keep us flying, drifting downward, all cushioned against the screeching furnace of jets just feet away, against the whispering rumble of cars as we princes of the middle air observe those headlights like souls moving in Dante's paradise smoothly along their destined paths, the glow of ruby tail lights, bright gold of advertising signs for soup and motels, twinkling jewels that earth must be glad to wear, that make her seem fairer than the evening air clad in the beauty of a thousand stars. And surely Marlowe's Helen or Shakespeare's Cleopatra never wore words so brilliant as this multitudinous space incarnadined into which we descend with ordinary lives and dirty socks, flashing us messages which as we touch down become mere signs of ordinariness or sleaze, unmidest opposite of pond scum that under a microscope bustles with alien beings, this city close up just dissolves and pretends to be like us. Bricks, asphalt, glass, hustle, smog dazzle, horn blare. But I was going to say, when literature broke in with all her fancy stuff about Cleo and Helen, not just that all these lights are exquisite when seen from far enough away, but that so much of all this brilliance lights up our fear of violence and greed. I know that sounds peculiar. What I mean is that the lights aren't needed to show us things. Damn it, nobody really needs to see the highways all that well. The showcase windows there along Broadway don't need to be lit up at night. Of course, they shine partly to make us want their jewels, gimcracks, airbrushed sex, their magic carpets to the Hesperides in light-filled windows. But still, that light spells meant as much to keep off burglars and muggers, smash and grab by those who can't afford Hesperidean fruit and will settle for a bite of this big apple, worms and all, haunting the lineaments of gratified desire. Surely seen from this middle heaven, they are beautiful, and those blue lights along our campus paths are rape lights, surely, and also very beautiful, aren't they? Messages of want and violence on earth, they all look beautiful from here. But motel signs, you say, are hardly placed from fear. They're good Samaritans to heal wayfaring strangers' woes. What's bought by the crown jewel spilling from Best Western signs into our midnight windshields is hope, is comfort, bright enough to see from far off shining there. And that's true, too. And yes, these signs of fear and faith are costlier than Cleo's imperial gems and snakes. The wealth of many continents is burned to set their many colors glowing, and they speak the loveliest art that merchants of desire ever invented, that which turns a sleazy, murderous Times Square of Smogdom and Gomorrah into Elysium at night, a brilliant mob of souls who dwell in possibility, just the place to go and become a star, among glittering towers with elevators and many black-lunged coal miners, cancerous rivers to keep their brilliance climbing towards the stars, high over that darkened babel of many tongues below. Here's lighting up two. In the Hotel Empire's coffee shop at 63rd and Broadway, across from Lincoln Center, facing the bronze back of Dante's statue in its little patch of pigeoned greenery, we are waited on hand and foot, Stella and I. Then red lights part the sea of traffic while we cross like Moses to the promised land of Strauss, Stravinsky, Berlioz, where graceful as dolphins the Hudson River leaps for us on the Fountain Plaza. And on this day of cold falling rain, this night of icebound gutters, the seats are plushy warm, the stage played on by magic lights that show a nightingale danced by Makarova, delivering from death the Chinese emperor danced by Anthony Dowell. The singers down in the darkened orchestra pit, gilding with liquid sound the dancing lilies. Then storms of applause bring through the parted curtains the dancers, singers, orchestra, conductor. Then the chandeliers descend, glittering as the audience rises and we go, Stella and I, into a special room for Met supporters and, acting like teenagers, have champagne. The people in this Belmont room are quieter, more silver-haired, have pleasant faces, don't like standing up. The waiters who supply champagne for us and one Coca-Cola for our music-loving friends and colleagues who met us in the lobby are New York versions of Lord Byron's best valet. Elysium indeed! A hotel not expensive, 2 days and 3 nights of such music, of salmon mousse and hot steamed chocolate with whipped cream, nights in soft beds, with time and privacy and maids to repair, replace each morning what is crumpled, soiled, crumb-laden, wet, used up. So when we go out and walk round in front of Dante, we are not yet ready to abandon hope, having entered, as full citizens, within the empire's most affluent city, we shall depart on shining wings and soaring above all storms return to the Father of Waters and our small provincial tasks of making Virgilian Rome and Dante's Florence worth relating to. I think I'm going to pass over the Oklahoma side of that. I've got that written, but I'm not that happy with it. So I think I'll let that part go for now. And maybe try one or more of the pieces from here. Let me try Coming of Age in the County Jail. This is a little visit. It's a dialogue, a couple people, one guy visiting. One guy a little bit more permanently there. I see they worked you over. What you in for? Oh, I took this kiddie car out of a guy's backyard Friday midnight. What in the world gave you the idea for that? Celebrate my birthday. Me and George decided we'd haul it up on top of the mound, ride down on that kiddie car, see if we could finish off the wine on the way down. That's how you got the black eye and stitches, no doubt. Not hardly. Turned out the guy whose yard we took it from was a city cop. He saw us put it in our car and start off down the mound road. Where'd they catch up with you? We got out near the mound. Here come three patrol cars with sirens and red lights flashing, blocked off the road. Big mob of police jumped out with guns. Well, what'd you say to them? Mostly we said, ow, that's enough. I made the mistake of hitting back at a couple. After they got me down in the back of the car with handcuffs on behind my back, they beat me on the shoulder blades with blackjacks. This cut my eyebrows from a pistol, though. Yeah, looks like it. What are you charged with now? That's a pretty good list of things they mention. Felony for taking the kiddie car, which the officer valued at over $50. Then there's assaulting an officer, resisting arrest, driving with open bottle, disturbing the peace, so on, so on. Nobody wants to have his kids' things stolen, especially police. Maybe the lawyer can get the charge reduced to misdemeanor once things cool down a little. They told me 15 minutes is all I had. I'll start back now. Well, don't wander off. Nah, I kind of think they'll let me stay till the hearing. Besides, service here is just great. Gourmet cooking. Here's the man. Thanks for dropping in. I'll read a poem called Driving in Oklahoma. On humming rubber along this white concrete, lighthearted between the gravities of source and destination, like a man halfway to the moon, in this bubble of tuneless whistling, at 70 miles an hour from the wind vents, over prairie swells rising and falling, over the quick off-ramp that drops to its underpass, and the truck thundering beneath as I cross with a country music twanging out my windows. I'm grooving down this highway, feeling technology's freedom's other name. When a meadowlark comes sailing across the windshield with breast shining yellow, and five notes pierce the windshield like a flash of nectar on mind, gone as the country music swells up and drops me, wheeling down my notch of cement-bottomed sky between home and away, and wanting to move again through country that a bird has defined wholly with song, and maybe next time see how he flies so easy when he sings. I'm going to read a couple Indian pieces over here to finish up with. Thought I would do one called People from the Stars first. I probably ought to say a word about the ceremonies and things that go behind this. When you're given your name, when you were given your name in the old days for the Osages, it was a considerable ceremony. You had a guy dressed up first to prepare to come in and sort of conduct as master of ceremonies. And as he was being, I don't know, dressed up is a hard word to use. You put on certain things. You put on paint, for example. You put on feathers, for example. And you know what paint and feathers are. They are cosmetics, of course. That's European notions, at least. But in the ceremony of naming, The guy is given these things at dawn, and just before dawn, the people come to his house to prepare him for the ceremony. Then they would go over to the house where the naming itself and the child was to be. The house itself became, where the child was, became for that time a symbolic representation of the universe. You had the 21 clans or so, different groups, seated in certain order, and this represented the ordering of the universe. They had them arranged in certain ways so that the sky people here, earth people here, and so on, and then the different clans. And as part of that, as later part of that ceremony, when the child was being named, each clan would recite its creation story, how it came from the stars to earth, and chose and was chosen by the animal or created being, the power being, to take that being as its, you might say, protector, guide, and as giving its body that they might live to see old age, as they put it. And these clans, these groups, one of them, the red eagle, the red cedar, the mountain lion, black bear, the various things like this. So that's the house over there. The ordering of that is very carefully arranged so that the way in which the universe moves is represented by it. But I'm talking now, for the moment, about the part where the man is given his clothes and clothes and other things. But I'm talking about paint and feathers. When there are recitations, there are sort of scenarios with recitations and then songs and so on that go with these two. When the man is preparing to receive the paint on his cheeks, the other man goes to the door of the house, and as the sun rises there with the red light, first the dawn, he holds his hands out like that. And then they recite this thing that says, with what shall the little ones decorate their faces as they travel the path of life, that they may live to see old age? And the answer to that is given as they do this. With the sun, with he who sitteth in the heavens, he who moveth in the heavens, and so on. The man has his hands out to the red light there. He comes back with the red paint on. He puts it on his cheeks. Then they say, with what shall he place, what shall he place in his scalp lock here that will, in effect, ensure him life, won't say everlasting, to old age. And as you look out at the sun in the morning after that reddening there, when the sun first comes up, there are, they say, two shafts of light that come up like this, two plumes. So as the question is asked, with what shall I decorate the scalp lock, the answer is given, with the shafts there of light and with the white feathers of the eagle's tail thing there that they place in here as they go. And then there is a gorget, a mussel shell, which goes on. So then there is buffalo fat, which the anointed with. The effect of all this is to say, in effect, that the child is going to be given the powers everlasting of the sun, who rises every day, who never fails to take his path, and who pursues that path. You have the first red, you have the white of that, and then you have the sun at noon, and so on. Here, and then you have the earth's plenty with the buffalo fat, and so on. So the creation stories described coming from the stars, and these are recited as well. But if you see paint and feathers now for Indians, that's by no means. There are war kinds of things. There are the black of death, the charcoal, and so on. There are other kinds of things, but this naming here. People from the Stars was done. I did it when I went out to Las Vegas to give a paper on trickster tales back in 77. John Joseph Matthews has a book on the Osages in which this turns out to be a chapter title. I'd forgotten that. It's been years. I reviewed it for the American Oxonian back in 61, and I'd totally forgotten to use that title. I used it as the title of the poem, so I've now put a quote under it. Wajaji come from the stars by their choice, not by falling or being thrown out of the heavenly bars like Satan into Europe. And we're invited back whenever we may choose to go. But we joined the people of death and moved to another village. We call it Ho'ega, where time began. We made our fire places and made our bodies of the golden eagle and the cedar tree, of mountain lion and buffalo, of red bird, black bear, of the great elk, and of thunder, so that we may live to see old age and go back to the stars. Meantime, the Europeans pay us royalties for oil that lights their midnight highways, dangling across the land in star strings through the night. We trade our royalties for time, enthroned on wings of shining metal, to look down at the stars beneath or up at stars above, before we touch down in the desert creation of Las Vegas and wheel off to shoot craps at the Stardust Inn and talk of Indians and their trickster tales of Manobozho up inside Wounded Knee. I guess I'll finish with a poem called Dancing with Dinosaurs. So I've tried to talk to you a little bit about feathers. You have some sense of what I mean when I talk about them. I belong to a group in here in St. Louis called the St. Louis Gourd Dancers. And the gourd I was using at the time that I wrote this had some parrot feathers really on top of them. A lot of gourds just have a horsetail or something on top. These are things you shake as you dance with the gourd dancers. So I had been reading about the warblers, the little black and white warblers that fly all the way from Nova Scotia and Maine over Bermuda without landing, about 3 days and nights, and go to Venezuela. And I got to thinking about the powers of those little birds as I was shaking the gourd here. And we had a ceremony in September in which Evelyn Joaquini Volker, is a Comanche woman who lives across in Illinois. Her granddaughter was being brought, you know, sort of in as one of us there. So I put this together. The other thing, of course, is that birds, making a fuss lately about whether birds descend from dinosaurs and represent the sort of living survival of dinosaurs. So I call it Dancing with Dinosaurs because they have survived. First part of the poem is about the survival of the birds, and the second is about our dancing to survive. Before we came to Earth, before the birds had come, they were dinosaurs. Their feathers were a bright idea that came this way. See? Two tiny creatures, weighing 2 ounces each, keep quiet, and among the ferns observe bright-eyed the monsters tear each other and disappear. These two watch from the edge of what some 50 billion spins of the cooling earth ahead will be called Nova Scotia. Now with reptilian whistles they look southward as Pangaea breaks apart and lets the young Atlantic send its thunder crashing up to the pines where they cling with minuscule bodies in a tossing wind. In a September night and chilly rain, they sing and spread small wings to flutter out above surf spray. They rise to 20,000 feet on swirling winds of a passing cold front that lift them over the grin of sharks southeastward into sun. And all day winging under him pass high above the pink and snowy beaches of Bermuda, flying through zero cold and brilliance into darkness, then into moonlight, over steel leviathans with their mimic pines that call them down to rest and die. They bear southeast steadily, but the trade winds come and float them curving back southward over the windward islands and southwestward into marine and scarlet of their third day, coming down to 4,000 feet, still winging over Tobago, descending as the scaly waves widen into the surf of Venezuela. And they drop through moonlight down to perch on South America's shoulder, having become the male and female singers, having put on their feathers and survived. And the second part. When I was named a thunder person, I was told, here is a being of whom you may make your body, that you may live to see old age. Now, as we face the drum and dance shaking the gourds, this gourd is like a rainbow of feathers, lightly fastened with buckskin, fluttering as the gourd is shaken. The eagle feathers I have still not earned. It is the small birds only whose life continues on this gourd, whose life continues in our dance, that flutter as the gourd is rattled, and we dance to honor on a sun-bright day, and in the moon-bright night, the little girl being brought in, becoming one of us, as once was done for me, for each of us who dance. The small birds only who have given their bodies that a small girl may live to see old age. I have called them here to set them into song, who made their rainbow bodies long before we came to earth, who, learning song and flight, became beings for whom the infinite sky and trackless ocean are a path to spring. Now they will sing, and we are dancing with them here. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. The pink flyer is correct. The next Duff's poetry reading is going to be on April 9th, and it's Julie Heifetz and Diane Ackerman and Naomi Nye. So I hope to see you then.